Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now, not ever.
I mean...
These comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
Yeah, but I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day and thanks for joining us on Democracy Sausage, which, as you know, comes out twice weekly from the ANU. I'm Mark Kenny. Well, Donald Trump hangs on despite the lack of any evidence of systemic vote rigging, his childish rhetoric showing no signs of abating in what surely would be an embarrassment to grown-up Americans. And, of course, the coronavirus hangs on too, wreaking havoc in the US and elsewhere. In the UK, the Johnson government is now easing restrictions despite recording staggering numbers of new infections, something like 15,000 a day recently. Johnson, quickly emerging as the least competent PM in his country's recent history, is now slave to the toxic politics of corona, replete with Tory denialism and a backbench revolt, having bungled just about every stage of his government's response. Yet here in Australia, the worst-hit state is apparently virus-free now, and there are signs the economy is also rebounding strongly, presaging an end, technically speaking anyway, to the devastating COVID recession of 2020. But there's plenty of pain to come yet, with businesses pushed to the brink, and some, perhaps many, already gone. And if the economic pain of the crisis is not already terrible, there's extra hardship from the worsening trade fight with China. And never quiet for long, the Middle East is now on high alert over the assassination of Iran's top nuclear physicist, reportedly by Israeli agents. If there is an upside, it's that global progress on climate change suddenly seems just a bit more possible thanks to Trump's removal. Joining me to range across these issues and any others are a couple of excellent guests from the ANU. John Blaxland is Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies and the former head of the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the ANU. He's one of Australia's foremost experts on war and security and intelligence matters. And John, I imagine you're rather bemused, like many of us, that Australia is taking flak from Russia now in terms of the response over the Afghan war crimes investigation that we've had going on, the Brereton report. Russia's now saying that Australia's got big questions to answer. It seems a bit rich, doesn't it?
Yes, I think it's the pot calling the kettle black, to be honest. But it would be funny if it wasn't tragicomic. Russia's track record is outrageously bad. Its actions in Syria in support of the Assad regime, its actions in Nagorno-Karabakh and elsewhere is, you know... let alone with the Skripal poisoning and various other nefarious deeds around the world.
Or shooting down an airliner, which had...
Shooting down the airliner, exactly.
Many Australians on board as well as many others.
Continuing to deny its role in that, even though we now pretty much gather that that wasn't a deliberate shooting down of a civilian airliner. It was definitely a deliberate shooting down of an aircraft.
Hmm.
The denial of that speaks to a... an arrogant sense of being above accountability and reproach. You know, it's extraordinary on one level that they would feel that that's their role, but it does speak to a closeness emerging between the CCP, the Xi's government, and Putin's government.
Yeah, that's an interesting development in itself, isn't it? Because they've historically had a fractious relationship over a long period. And so it's a kind of a worry in that sense. I mean, the other aspect, of course, and you mentioned Syria, but of course, the Russians have a pretty dark and nefarious history with Afghanistan as well. I mean, given that we're talking about Afghanistan in this regard, the SAS behaviour, the Russians' record in Afghanistan is pretty horrendous as well.
Indeed. Yeah, the track record there. I mean, no one comes out looking glorious in Afghanistan, unfortunately.
No, that's definitely
there's
true.
A long litany of disastrous and, incredible poor performance by great powers across the globe in Afghanistan. And I don't think that saga is going to end, even if the Americans do end up leaving sooner than later.
Yeah, there was a book several years ago now, called The Great Game, I think it was.
And, yeah, which is a powerful book, about particularly the late 19th century British-Russian contest over the twilight zone between the Russian and British empires on the edge of what was then India and Pakistan, and that space where Afghanistan sits just beyond the reach of complete central control from either Delhi or Moscow, and Delhi being back then part of the British Empire.
Yeah.
And of course, it's been an ebb and flow of great power contestation as part of that great game on and off ever since.
Yeah, that's right. And it's just been the ruin of even quite technologically advanced and wealthy nations that have had aspirations for control, and they just haven't. They've
exactly
just failed
right.
them. It ended in massive suffering and ignominy.
And enormous hubris, incredible hubris on the part of great powers who with an unwillingness to learn from history, have arrogantly trod in the paths of others that have preceded them without stopping to learn the lessons of their experience.
Yeah, and the Russians are now reportedly taking more of a renewed interest in Afghanistan.
As is China.
Yeah. Mm. Also with us is Dr. Siobhan McDonnell. She is a senior lecturer in the Crawford School of Public Policy. She's a lawyer and an expert anthropologist. And she's played a pivotal role in a whole range of things like climate change negotiations for countries in this region and in native title in Australia, as I understand it. Siobhan, welcome back to Democracy Sausage.
Thank you so much.
Really great to have you here. I noticed that I made a reference before about climate change, the atmospherics of it, if I could put it in that slightly unintentionally punnish way. Do you feel a bit more optimistic now that we've seen the change in the US administration, the very strong sort of intentions of the incoming Biden administration, the appointment of John Kerry as global climate envoy for President-elect Biden? It does rather change the global atmospherics, doesn't it, about what is a very global problem?
Yeah, I mean, there's a real politic to all of this. There's a pragmatics to the negotiations when you're in the room, which is that it's about who moves in what direction. And in the room in Madrid, the US obviously was a non-starter. Europe was not doing much as a group. The UK was signalling pretty ineffectually. And as a result, we came out with not much, really. I should say that I went, I had the honour of representing the Republic of Vanuatu in those negotiations. But this is really pivotally important in terms of thinking around the direction we're heading in as we progress towards Glasgow. So Glasgow is the point in time where we revisit the Paris targets. So in Paris, all of the parties to the agreement signed up to nationally determined contributions. The idea was
these are the so-called 2030 targets.
Yes, and the idea was that they would be ratcheted up, and that process will now happen at Glasgow. So the UK is really strongly signalling its commitment. A whole range of countries are falling behind. What is pivotally important at this point in time is the Biden administration and how they sit. And what they need to do, and this is where John Kerry provides an incredibly important role is they need to develop an approach that speaks to a domestic commitment, so a similar kind of set of issues that we have in Australia, but also internationally. John Kerry has historically had a very important role to play in terms of brokering partnerships. So the position that he has been given is one that has a forward-facing security framing. So he's a member of cabinet. He's really been given a top-level cabinet role. That means he will now, the first things that he'll do is go to China and begin to try and work that partnership. So this is incredibly significant because the two largest emitting countries in the world are China and the US. So, you know, in terms of the climate science, in terms of those of us who are incredibly troubled about the direction that we're going in, we know that we've already hit 1 degree of global warming, possibly already 1.2 degree of global warming. The idea is not to hit 1.5 because then you start actually hitting planetary boundaries from which we cannot return. So the time is now. It's absolutely immediate and it's absolutely critical.
John, going to the point Siobhan makes about Kerry going to China, if that's what he does do, it seems like a bit of a pipe dream for Australia at the moment to be going to China and actually achieving anything, given that negotiations or the relationship seems to be so broken down. And we can come to that a bit later. But how do you view the possibilities there? I guess this isn't just a question about climate change. This is a question about reframing of the US-China relationship. Do you think there is potential for that relationship to improve? In some ways, it was defined by the kind of personal relationship between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping, and at its best, that had some positives to it, I suppose, because there's bipartisan hostility in Washington to China, or at least China's intentions and some of its behaviour. There's a willingness on both sides of the aisle, as they say in the US, to toughen up on China. But at the same time, the US is going to be looking for cooperation here and looking to show leadership. What do you think the chances are of that relationship becoming more productive?
I think the chances are as good as they've been in several years, but that isn't starting from a very high base. The Biden administration will face a very different set of dynamics to the ones that Obama faced, I believe, because the United States is now in a much more hostile mood towards China than it was 4 years ago. That's been reinforced by Trump's posturing, by China's actions, and by internationally, South China Sea, the much more clear track record of cyber attacks, cyber interference, political interference,
and coronavirus.
That's the big one I was coming to. The big one is the coronavirus. The fact that China has essentially been hiding its role, it's been denying that it's played a critical role in the early days and has not been prepared to be transparent about what happened and what we can do about it. But to make matters worse, from a US president's point of view, Xi seems to have come out of this with an economy that is relatively considerably stronger. And that is galling to the United States. It's hugely challenging in terms of the great power contestational dynamics that are continuing to shift. So while John Kerry, I wish him the very best, and we can only hope that he is successful in negotiating something effective with China, because as Siobhan points out, the two biggest emitters are the ones who we need to be looking to influence things. My concern is that on both sides, they will be playing more with smoke and mirrors than with substance, because China has, in my view, been very effective at playing the rhetoric and not necessarily playing the substance on environmental change, changing policies, and projecting things out intergenerationally when they know that they're essentially pie in the sky propositions, and they're still doubling down on coal production and nuclear weapons and nuclear energy consumption. So those dynamics are going to make it very, very hard for John Kerry to achieve something. But at the same time, President Xi and the Chinese government, they want a circuit breaker too. My concern out of all of this is whether we in Australia are collateral damage in that equation. We need to be very, very careful about how we play our cards from here on in.
Well, that's a really interesting point, Siobhan, isn't it, the where Australia fits in? Because we've been, in the last few years, since the overlap of the Trump administration and this coalition government we have in Australia, there's been a willingness to kind of, in a sense, hide in the shadow behind the US a bit on the question of a net zero by 2050 target, for example, on how muscular we're going to be. Have we just lost our protection? Are we just standing out there now, out in the driveway, kicking gravel around with Saudi Arabia while others are going to be in the conference making decisions?
Yeah, I think Australia is looking increasingly exposed. We know that Boris Johnson called Scott Morrison last week and asked him to shift his position. We know the previous Obama administration spoke very strongly towards the Australian Prime Minister about these particular issues. We know that this is increasingly becoming a fixed part of the international compact. We know that Morrison recently has started to talk about not using Kyoto carryover credits, which is quite a significant concession and something that was so distasteful and seen as not within the spirit and compact of the agreement internationally. So
Australia's already, sorry to interrupt, but Australia's already viewed with a fair amount of suspicion anyway. And then we're looking to, because we've negotiated a pretty soft deal in Kyoto to begin with, outrageously soft.
Extremely soft. And our Paris commitment is also very soft. So, you know, in terms of our Paris commitment, it would mean that Australia would, you know, we're contributing to a world in which there's about 3% global warming, so far in excess of where climate science predicts is anything like safe and habitable future global world. So, look, Australia is already seen very much as an international outlier, pariah, and now we are increasingly isolated with countries like Brazil and Saudi Arabia. So it's really, I think it's genuinely untenable as a position, but I also acknowledge that domestically these are extremely difficult, and we can see that across the domestic spectrum. We can see that in Labor politics in the same way that we can see it in the coalition. There is a real need for a just transition debate to happen in Australia in a very engaged way that perhaps hasn't happened in Australian politics to date.
Yes, and by just transition, I take it you mean we need to recognise that there are losers arising from a fairly rapid change in structure of the economy, a greening of the economy, moving to more renewables, taking fossil fuels out, lowering our emissions quite dramatically in a relatively short space of time. There are going to be people, particularly in the coal and energy production sector, who are going to be victims of that change. I've written about this myself recently.
And who need to be accommodated because of that.
It needs to be recognised, doesn't it? And it's interesting that I've spoken to a few people around writing that piece that on the Labor side and a couple since who've contacted me about it. And it's interesting that there is a growing recognition that unless you actually have a way of compensating these people, of accommodating their disadvantage and doing it up front, then you are going to have a major political problem. And we know Joel Fitzgibbon recently quit the front bench. He's, you know, prosecuting this argument. It's a lie, of course, and we've made this point on this podcast before. It's basically a lie to tell coal industry workers that they've got an indefinite future because they don't. So the more responsible thing to be saying is this is where we think the economy needs to go. This is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to pay for it. This is a national restructuring and therefore you won't be individually asked to carry the cost.
And when are we going to be mature enough to have that conversation? right? So increasingly what we're seeing is that the states are progressively having a conversation that at a national level we seem to be incapable of having, right?
Well, is Morrison going to be saved by the states? I mean, we saw New South Wales sign a quite progressive package in the last 8 days, I think, last week, in fact.
With huge energy transition implications.
Yeah.
So we've got movements in New South Wales. We've got movements in Victoria. We have existing movements in South Australia.
We have big movements from corporate Australia, where companies like Woolworths going carbon neutral by, 2035 or something.
We've got the banks lining up in particular directions to some degree. We've got, we've got the top end of corporate Australia who have already done risk analysis and have pulled a lot of their investments out of anything. They do this incredible work in that future financing work where they actually project risks out into the future and pull out anything that looks like it's a projected liability from a whole range of different sectors. So when Malcolm Turnbull speaks, he speaks with the authority of that high finance kind of sector and the way in which they project the future, the global future of what's happening, of the way we're progressing. In the future, there will be certain sectors that will be uninsurable. There will be certain forms of housing that will be uninsurable, right? So this is the direction that we're heading in increasingly. It is absolutely the direction we're heading in. The climate science is simply uncontestable. So the question is, how do we get there? And this is what is absent from that kind of national debate at the moment.
It's just, John, hasn't it been just like an extraordinary period of the politics being so toxic that policy has just played second fiddle all the time? It's always hopelessly compromised. Rational policy ideas just are incapable of being assessed or progressed in any way because they fall on either one side or other or of a sort of a toxic divide on this question. And we see that divide within the parties as well as across the two parties.
Yeah, so that comes to the core of the issue I was trying to grapple with the geostrategic SWOT analysis for Australia I wrote last year. Essentially, we have a political system caught up with the tyranny of the urgent. And no one seems to be able to rise above the short-term political cycle of the 24-hour news cycle, let alone the three-year political cycle, to think generationally and intergenerationally about where we need to be, how we need to position Australia for the sake of our grandkids. So this is, you know, one of the weaknesses of our democratic practice at the moment is that it just struggles to rise above that kind of narcissistic local issue focus about holding on to power and grappling with pushback in local electorates to issues that really need to be recast in a completely different light. I've been arguing that we need a National Institute for Net Assessment. And what I mean by that is a body that looks holistically at where the country's at, where we want to be, and how we get there. So we have a serious look at, you know, we talk about in the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre, we talk about strategy in a very simplified sense, that's ends, ways, and means. Well, we think we haven't had that conversation as a nation about where do we want to be in 50 years and what are the resources we've got to do that and how can we get there? There's a gaping chasm of that conversation representing that absence. So we need to do that. And Siobhan's points are really good. They're butting up against the reality of that short term, fairly toxic political process, that we've seen unfold in politics, you know, pretty much for the last decade and a half, just tripping over ourselves, almost getting there with policy that one side of politics or a third party thinks it's not good enough or, you know, thinks they can eke out another compromise and then it topples over. It's unfortunate that we're in that position. You know, here we are, late 2020. We've had a national cabinet that back in March and April seem to augur in a new era of collegiality and of visionary engagement on issues. And yet we haven't it appears, being able to rise above that and kind of make that into an institutional mechanism for visionary change. We've been caught up with politics, the local politics, the state-based issues, the federal-state tussles, you know, out he-manning each other, you know, trying to show each other who's got the strongest views.
Interesting point. Imagine if National Cabinet had picked energy solutions to focus on post-COVID and we'd actually got some kind of energy strategy out of a National Cabinet.
And all the investment
that's the
we've
point.
Made.
We can't do that because it's so politicized. So anyone who suggests that, the very act of suggesting it is a political act in Australia's political culture.
Yet we're putting ourselves into hock in, you know, I don't know how many billions it is now we're up to. It's hard to keep track, but we're spending a lot.
600, I think.
Okay. We're spending a lot. Where's the plan? You know, this just seems to be scattergun. There doesn't seem to be a really coherent plan.
Well, this
is that
sort of mismatch between the obvious or relatively easily seen longer term interests of a country and the short term electoral cycle. It's always been too easy to tell people what they are proposing means your electricity bill is going to go up. Stick with us, and people then vote with their hip pocket. I mean, we can't relieve the Australian voters of some level of some role here in this. I mean, people have responded to these levels of populism. Look at Tony Abbott's win in 2013. It was a relentless attack on the carbon price, as if it was the devil incarnate. It was, the wrecking ball on the economy, the python squeeze, all that sort of rhetoric that in the end people voted for that. They voted to get rid of the carbon tax. And we now know, we can look at the numbers, it was the period during which the Australia's emissions started to reduce. So, they did. And so it's it's an extraordinary failure. Let's just take a quick break and come back and continue this discussion.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. We were talking about climate change as a diabolical political problem. I wonder what you both think about the idea of, and I'm not sure who suggested this, it might have been your colleague Siobhan at the Crawford School, John Hewson, from memory, although it might have been someone else, the idea of having the emissions reduction target set by a statutory body, a bit in the same way that the Reserve Bank sets the interest rate, the official cash rate, take it right out of politics, have a body that's set up that looks at all of the all of the indicators, all of the economic implications, all of the environmental implications, weighs it all up. Has some guidelines, of course, like the Reserve Bank has to keep the inflation rate between 2 and 3%. It would have to have guidelines, but its goal would be to achieve a particular, let's call it a 2050 outcome, for example. What do you think of that idea?
I think it'd be wonderful to have a deeply scientific approach to some of these issues. We know that putting in place a trading scheme is an effective solution. We know that this is the kind of approach that allows for a market mechanism that can allow adjustments to be made in an efficient and effective way. I think what's interesting is, and a lot of people have made this comparison, is that one of the things that the government really needs to take credit for is the incredibly exceptional way in which Australia has responded to COVID. And a lot of that involved listening to the science.
Yes, really.
So there's a really interesting point of contrast there, right? We're prepared to listen to the science. We're prepared to understand the importance of epidemiology. We're prepared to take on board the importance, even if there's this incredible economic cost, even if it means transforming the ways in which we think about our lives, even if it costs jobs, right? Mm. And it has cost jobs, and it has come at a desperate economic cost. And yet, why are we not applying a similar rationale to what is really an even more, some would say, an even more pressing issue?
Is that, John, in your view, simply human psychology? One of these processes is a long-run thing, and in that sense it's abstract, it's global, and it's down the track, a long way down the track, and its implications are gradual. The other is a here-and-now existential health threat. We know that most climate change deniers rush to the doctor at the first chance of first sign of any sort of illness, and if they are unlucky enough to be diagnosed with cancer, they will take all the chemotherapy and other therapies that science has developed for treating that. So they've always been hypocrites on this question, in my view. But is it just human psychology? We can a bit like why do we smoke when we're younger? Because it'll only be a problem so long later on in our lives.
It is a strange irony, isn't it, that we have responded so well to government edicts, science-based edicts on prevention of the pandemic and containment of the pandemic, and yet we've allowed the rhetoric of denial to resonate. And I think it's because there's been political expedience. And there's no doubt some people just don't believe it. You know, there is quite a buy-in.
Just don't believe climate change, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, that creating doubt around it has been a critical aspect, hasn't it? To at least have some sort of doubt or debate going on that allows people who don't want to confront it to be able to cite, you know, Terry McCrann or someone that read.
And those the naysayers are resonating in a way that is surprising, and it's feeding off. You know, we're in a bit of a weird space at the moment because of our media being affected by strong anti-climate change views, particularly let's be frank, it's particularly in the Murdoch press, but not just in the Murdoch press. And that is a very influential body in Australia. And that's resonating in large chunks of Australia. And the counter message is not being sufficiently well articulated or conveyed or marketed. And that's self-reinforcing because then that plays to a political base and it plays to a message about, well, what's going to work best for, you know, maintenance of power. And this is exactly what Joel Fitzgibbon's butting up against in the Hunter Valley. Mm. And I get back to my point earlier, you know, we're not thinking in a visionary way about where we're going to be intergenerationally. We're just getting caught up with the here and now.
How you get elected. I mean, that's what Fitzgibbon's actually, in a way, he's guilty of this himself. He's saying we need to look after these workers.
Mm.
Well, that's understandable. I mean, they are, as he notes, they are in many ways the sort of foundation of the Labor Party, industrial blue-collar workers. It's an understandable argument to that extent.
But he's not making the counter-argument, which is that, what happened yesterday in New South Wales and northern New South Wales, the hottest day in November ever recorded.
And instantly there's bushfires lapping at some of the outer suburbs.
And the bushfires, I mean,
The wind yesterday was insane. You know,
so it's really interesting to me that we see climate change as a long, you know, a slow-burning existential crisis. And I understand that framing, and yet our experience is so palpable, you know. We began this year with these horrific and devastating fires, and we began this year through a lot of those southeastern coast of not being able to breathe for extended periods of time,
as well as horrendous. But isn't it all, isn't the weakness in that argument, or at least the vulnerability of that argument, that people will always say, "Oh, well, I remember the Great Flood of 1955, or the bushfires of
1939,
or 1983, or whatever," and I remember the heat wave when in the 1960s, or whatever it is. And so it's not actually feasible to link a single weather event, as they now describe it, with climate change. But it is certainly the
climate science is so clear. I mean, the climate science, I mean, we have fabulous data out of even the Bureau of Meteorology that they publish every year that people can access with a click. But, you know, I inhabit this space all the time, I can tell you. And what is absolutely terrifying is that if you look at sea level rise the way I do in the Pacific, the modelling has changed dramatically, even between a couple of years ago and now, because what is happening is the Arctic and the Antarctic are melting much faster than anyone ever predicted. And we have some of these modellers based at ANU. So the rapid transformation of the climate systems across the globe are happening at much faster rates than anyone anticipated. This is starting to spin at a level that we had not imagined.
And the trouble with that is that once it becomes so unambiguous that not even, you know, your sort of enthusiastic deniers can deny it any longer, is it's gone well past the point where much more, you know, serious action needed to be taken. Because these people are clinging on endlessly, and we've got a government that is dragging the chain. John, what about the sort of security aspect? Because I noticed you mentioned the Murdoch Press a minute ago. There's a faint air of panic in some of the commentary I've seen around this changing atmospheric of the Biden administration, John Kerry. There was talk about, you know, the climate advisor that Australia doesn't need. Well, it might actually be the climate advisor Australia does need, actually, a bit of external pressure, because, you know, someone's got to sort of get Australia to stop dragging the chain. But I wonder, one of the criticisms that was in that piece that I read the other day was that Tony Abbott had dealt with John Kerry back in 2014 when he was Secretary of State under Obama, that is John Kerry. And the criticism that Abbott made was that John Kerry, even discussing security issues, seemed to only want to talk about climate change, you know, as if this was a thing. But it is increasingly a security concern, isn't it?
So going back to my SWOT analysis, one of the things I point out in that is that I put a Venn diagram. My distillation of the so what from the SWOT analysis is that we've got overlapping concerns that are about looming environmental catastrophe, but we've also got great power contestation. And those two things is actually leaping in with a third one, which is a spectrum of governance challenges ranging from terrorism, people smuggling, drug smuggling, breakdowns in law and order, illegal fishing, and a lot of brown paper bags being shifted around the place, really undermining our system of governance in Australia, in the Pacific, in Southeast Asia. So the overlap of those three components of the Venn diagram is developing a dark space that is actually not just about environmental catastrophe. It's not just about great power contestation, and it's not just about terrorism or law and order. It's actually the mix. And that is a very toxic mix. And so what we're facing is, and you know, Siobhan's got expertise in environmental sciences and environmental issues. I come to it as a, you know, with a hard power perspective, but trying to be open-minded about all of the spectrum of issues. And what I'm seeing is that we actually need to really reimagine how we respond. And my sense is that we have to grapple with the political reality, and that is that there is a big chunk of the Australian community that doesn't buy it. But what they do buy is something else. So they buy terrorism, or they buy great power contestation. And this is why I think one of the things I've proposed is a grand compact for the Pacific. People say, "Oh, John, you got to focus on the environment." I'm saying, "Look, I'm trying to skin this cat here. And if that's all you focus on, you're not going to get it over the line." And let's face it, they face more than just environmental challenges. They face considerable pressure from great power contestation. Mm-hmm. And all of those governance challenges are palpable in the Pacific and in Southeast Asia, but particularly in the Pacific. So I think we as a nation, what we need to be mindful of that. And if, you know, for the people who do see environment as the biggest issue, need to be more, if you want to see it being successfully prosecuted, you need to factor in how other parts of the political spectrum view this issue and work to come up with a consensus that is going to actually achieve realistic goals. And that's why I think the Grand Compact for the Pacific is important, you know, where we offer a deal to particularly the microstates of the Pacific, to a bit like New Zealand's offered with Tonga and has with Tonga, with the Niue and the Cook Islands, and the United States has with some of the islands in the northern hemisphere. But I guess the issue is that not one of those three domains is if you focus on them, you're not going to succeed. That's my sense. So you are going to butt up against enormous institutional barriers if you only focus on environmental issues. But we do face enormous pressures, and we're seeing it with trade at the moment, the barriers with coal being held up. And it's interesting that it's coal that's being held up off the ports of China at the moment.
Well, it's because it's not just coal, is it? I mean, coal is being held up, as you say, the 60 ships or something sitting off Chinese ports. But yeah. We've got now problems with wine that have just been announced and the whole rain, barley and a number of other things.
I think we're facing a moment that echoes Britain's move into the European Economic Community in 1973, when we and New Zealand had to make an inflection point for us in terms of our trade priorities. We lost enormous markets with Britain because they basically cut us off.
Mm. We remember.
But essentially, you know, they had to do it for very pragmatic reasons. Charles de Gaulle was refusing to let Britain in unless they cut off the empire. And that was, he was being extremely hard-nosed with Britain about that. And they felt back then that they had no option. You got to make your bed and your line.
That's real politics.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we can't hold it against them. But today we need to be mindful of what our options are. And this is where I think, you know, one of the things that I'm very happy to be supportive of is our engagement in the Pacific and our engagement in Southeast Asia. I really think we've undercooked our relationships in the Pacific and in Southeast Asia. And in part because, you know, I like to think, Australians, I contend, are barely monolingual. You know, we're not very good internationally across cultures. We like to gravitate towards the other English speaking nations. And if it's not that, then it's a big target like China, where it's pretty straightforward. You get an interpreter to help you. The world's getting more complicated, and we've kind of skipped over Southeast Asia and South Asia and other markets because they've been hard. Mm. But we've got IACEPA, the Indonesia-Australia Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement. We've got Australia-New Zealand ASEAN Free Trade Agreement. We've got RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. We're part of all of these. These are mechanisms that we now as a nation need to double down on in terms of compensating for what looks like to be a fairly long set shift from China. But there's another side to it. It's very interesting because China's playing hardball here, but the whole world is watching. Everybody is seeing that China is actually being pretty adversarial here. And this is a very sobering note for all of us around the world to note that if you put too many eggs in the China basket, chances are they will look to manipulate you. And Australia's facing that. Now, we happen to be one of the most prosperous nations in the world. And like in 1973, my sense is we can take this hit and maintain our dignity. And I think it's also very important that we not compromise on some of the things that China is asking of us. We would never be allowed to ask of China what they are asking of us. And I think that needs to be put to them. And I think, you know, the world is watching to see how Australia responds. I think Australia needs to play with a very, very straight bat, very carefully and deftly, Now, I know we've kind of played things ham-fistedly over the last little while.
We have. I mean, let's be frank about it. We have rather invited some of these reactions.
Yep.
Not necessarily because we did the wrong thing, but because we framed it in the wrong way.
We can't undo that.
No.
We are where we are. We aren't where we were. And you know, there's that great line, you know, if that's where you wanted to go, I wouldn't start from here, but we have to. We're here and we have to manage where we are and manage our interests as well as our ideals. So realism and idealism has to – we have to – the yin and yang, if you like, of international relations, we have to hold that in balance somehow, and we have to chart a path forward which is going to look after Australian industry and farmers and various products and also reposition ourselves. It's very interesting that this is happening to coal, you know. This hopefully will be a sobering moment for us to think about, well, you know, we are a land of an enormous amount of sunshine, you know, and I think there is some repositioning of us as a nation as we think about, because, you know, a generation ago, it wasn't coal or iron ore. It was wool. It took a couple of generations ago. Okay. Yeah. We actually have shifted. We can shift again. And there are many other people in the world watching closely at what we do and how we respond. But I'd make another point also that when China stops buying our coal, it buys from someone else. And if it does so, then the market that they were already selling to is probably freeing up. So this is a very – it's quite dynamic space in the international trading system. So this is not a one or a zero. It's not on or it's off. This is always – there are ebbs and flows. There's fluctuations. There are changes. And it shifts from year to year. It's probably going to shift quite dramatically, I think, over the next little while. And this is probably – in some respects, a healthy wake-up call for us as a nation about the geostrategy, about the environmental impact of our choices, and about the governance choices we make as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, particularly in terms of the Pacific. What do you think, Siobhan, in terms of the how Australia is seen in the Pacific and how China is seen? They are seen in some ways to be two of the, you know, the bigger players. We've tried to show a degree of leadership. We're very aware of China's foray into a number of these Pacific Island nations, offering cheap loans and the like. We know at recent Pacific Islands forums, the issue of climate change has been absolutely preeminent as an issue. It's an existential sort of issue for a number of these low-lying nations. What are your thoughts? Is there potential for Australia to shift here and to show leadership on this question and thus to do representation for smaller states that don't have as much sway in the world as we do?
Well, we've talked about how Australia increasingly is looking at as an outlier. Mm-hmm. In the international context, we're looking at how we've discussed how domestically the national government's increasingly looking like it's removed from what the states are doing. And I think what we haven't discussed yet is the real regional cost of Australia not moving on some of these issues. So for a long time, the Australian government has put forward what is quite a complicated diplomatic position, which is quite generous funding of climate adaptation and mitigation programming at a local level through Pacific Island countries, but absolute recalcitrance around some crucial climate commitments at regional kind of levels around political compacts. That really came to a head in Tuvalu at the Pacific Islands Forum last year. Mm. I was there again negotiating on behalf of Vanuatu, so in the Pacific Island bloc against Australia and New Zealand. And what we came out with was the Kainaki 2 declaration. So that was negotiated for 6 weeks as part of the negotiation team. Scott Morrison flew in with his advisors, one of whom is a former Minerals Council of Australia representative, and looked at the agreement and was unhappy. So he then came and had 6 hours of trying to work that through the leaders' debate in Funafuti, and that was a very tense meeting of leaders at that point in time. The Kainaki 2 Declaration is still some of the highest commitments that the Australian government has ever signed up to in terms of climate, regional climate compacts. And I think what happens is that when you're located on Tuvalu, you're on a coral atoll, parts of that atoll are literally 1 metre above sea level. The optic of that meeting was that it was a community hall. The leaders were placed in the middle of the meeting area with windows on each side that overlooked the ocean. The ocean was literally lapping on either side of the meeting room. And the president of Tonga cried. You know, I mean, there are
This is the meeting where when world leaders arrived, well, for example, Scott Morrison arrived, there were some of the kids that were there to greet them were sitting in water.
They were waist deep in water. So there was
a sort of a gesture to
waist deep in water with a scene of disaster that had been created behind them and a plaque that read, "We call on you, the leaders of the Pacific, to secure our future."
Hmm.
So the whole optic, you know, across, you know, across Funafuti were these signs that said there is no planet B everywhere you went, really. And every night this incredible gathering of Tuvalu custom celebration of dance performance that was going on. And this, you know, this perpetual question in the back of your mind of, well, what happens? What happens in the future? So the Pacific came and they met and Morrison had to front up to them. And, you know, I won't go into the detail of what happened, although a lot of it came out in various ways in the media, but it was not a great show of Australian diplomacy.
Do you think there's any potential for that to change? I mean, I know that's asking you to be sort of optimistic, and I'm guilty of this kind of optimism from time to time and mostly have regretted it. But, you know, given what we were discussing at the start of this recording, the change into the, you know, of the Biden administration and the changing atmospherics, the fact that Morrison is now not talking about using carryover credits, the fact that he's saying, well, we think we can get to, we'd like to get to net zero before 2050 and we think we'll certainly do it, you know, in this. I mean, he's obviously going to be very reluctant to back down from his statement that we're not going to have a 2050 target.
But I think the question is, and John would probably frame it similarly and differently to me, is how long can Australia afford not to change? So China is moving into the Pacific in an increasingly with increasing overtures. One of the things about Chinese development diplomacy is there's very little strings attached to it. So if you're a politician in a Pacific Island country and you want something funded, it's much easier to get it funded by China.
Particularly if China sees it as a sort of a contest with Australia, and our relationship has become
and is interested in creating a strategic partnership with you as a Pacific Island leader. Australia's spend is larger. Australia is still often the partner of choice. Australia has a long history of funding some extraordinary long development partnerships around schooling, around hospitals, around roads and infrastructure. These long-term development pathways, and yet they need to signal directions towards the future. And this is a critical issue, not just for atoll nations, but for all nations in the Pacific as weather patterns change. Across Melanesia, people are still subsistence farmers, and they're finding it increasingly hard to grow crops with changing weather patterns. So you're looking at food security issues for 9 million people. I mean, these are issues that are on Australia's border. They are coming. So what is our future solution for this? I mean, and I want to say in relation to John's kind of, you know, where's our 2050 plan, if it doesn't sound too indulgent, universities have got to be part of that plan, right? There's a short-termism about the way this politics is framed that is just really depressing. It's depressing in terms of policy agendas, but it's depressing. And I don't think that punters are that stupid. You know, I actually think I have more faith in people than that. I actually think people want different options for their kids, and I think they do want different solutions being presented.
Yes, well, I hope that you are right. I think you are right, but it is sometimes it can be difficult to tell, as we've seen through, well, as we saw 70 million people still wanted Donald Trump as the president after all of the abuses and outrage that his presidency represented. So, you know, one always needs to temper one's enthusiasm for the judgment of the mob to some extent. Look, just in the time we've got left, I want to quickly turn to the situation in the Middle East, particularly I mentioned in the introduction about the obviously that we're all glad that Kylie Moore-Gilbert has been brought home from Iran. Within a couple of days of that, we see the assassination of this top nuclear physicist, which Iran is saying is an act of Israeli intelligence. Any thoughts on, are these things linked, these two events, for a start? What are your thoughts on Australia's role? Have we seen, for example, a rather unfortunate successful exercise in hostage diplomacy from Iran? Have we played into that? And were you surprised to read that a significant part of Australia's diplomatic effort was in fact conducted by senior intelligence officials?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. You know, the Middle East has had this incredible pull on Australian diplomacy and foreign engagement. We've been going there since before Federation. 1885, we first sent a contingent to Sudan, which isn't the Middle East. It's in Africa, but it's not just on the edges of the Middle East, North Africa strip. The dynamics in Iran, in the Middle East, are ones that we Australians are, you know, we're really, it's not our principal focus and it's not our principal area of expertise, but we do have very, very good people in that space. But I think we need to place the context of what's happening in Iran in a broader context in terms of the great Sunni-Shia tussle between Saudi Arabia and Iran and America's role in that space. And, of course, what's happening with the Biden administration coming in following in 4 years of the Trump love-in with the Saudi Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, there is probably a significant shift afoot in the dynamics there. So
do you think Israeli agents, the Israeli security services, were green-lighted by the Trump administration to go ahead with this, or do you think there's any relationship between the assassination of this physicist and the release of Kylie Moore-Gilbert?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. We can't be categoric. There's no question in my mind that it's not beyond Israel's capacity to do something like that. They've demonstrated that before. Whether or not there's something internal in Iran that's going on, we can't completely discount as well. But certainly in terms of capacity, capability, Israel has it. The dynamics would point to that being a likely prospect.
In your judgment, would they have waited or been asked to wait for the playing out of this other process to secure the release of Kylie Moore-Gilbert? I guess we can't know the answer to this.
No one's going to tell us. No. But in terms of just, you know, working through the probabilities. We have diplomatic representation in Israel. We have diplomatic representation in Saudi Arabia and in Iran.
Unlike the US.
Unlike the US. So we are in a position for those embassies to be coordinating with each other through the diplomatic secure communications network to make sure that their messages are consistent and that their actions are coordinated. So that is plausible, and it would be it would be unprofessional if they hadn't been looking to fend off any kind of disruptions to what has demonstrably been a considerable investment in making sure that that release happens. So very interesting to see Nick Warner play a role,
yes,
the Director General of the Office of National Intelligence, the peak intelligence policy, intelligence analysis and oversight position, you know, the head of basically the head of Australia's National Intelligence. He's been playing a role, having formerly been in ASIS, as head of ASIS beforehand, and former diplomat in the rest of the other part of DFAT beforehand, very well placed to capitalise on his network. Very interesting to see our relationship with Thailand played in this space. Mm. This is Thailand, because I've got a close connection with Thailand, having lived there for a number of years. But Thailand's one of these kind of underappreciated second tier nations for Australia. It's not an immediate neighbour, but it's been a very important partner for us over the years in crisis resolution. The Cambodian peace resolution of 1992-93, Thailand was pivotal. In East Timor crisis of 99, Thailand was the first country to volunteer to help us, broke the ice, and then others followed. Critical, critical move by Thailand to help us. And here we see Thailand again playing a very critical supporting role to Australia, reflecting an investment in the bilateral relationship going back generations. I've got a book coming out any day now with ANU Press, Niche Wars on Australia in Afghanistan and Iraq. I've written that mindful of Australia's military focus in that space, edited that book, I should say, written chapters in it. And yet I'm very much more a Southeast Asianist. That's my bigger focus. And I see that Australia's investment in that space matters enormously, but it's not one or the other. Clearly we need to manage both. And there's an incredible multiple layers of complexity here and we're not going to see that, really that story unfold very, very clearly for quite some time yet, I'm sure.
Well, look, thank you both for, what's been a really terrific discussion today. I've got a list of other questions that I just haven't got to, and I feel bad about that. But at the same time, it's just been so interesting discussing the things that we have been discussing, and there's, I guess, always future podcasts where we can go into some of these questions more deeply. So thanks very much to Dr. Siobhan McDonnell and to Professor John Blaxland. It's been terrific, as said. And this is Democracy Sausage, as you know, comes out twice a week from the ANU. So I'll be back later in the week with content as yet undetermined, but I'm sure it'll be interesting. So we look forward to talking to you then. Thank you. Bye for now.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.